And good evening, everyone. I'm Jerry Wells, and I want to thank you for joining us this evening for what I think is going to be, I'm certain it's going to be, a fantastic show. We're kind of on this trek right now where we're looking to find answers into the long-forgotten past and finding explanations here in the present. And one of the people that we have with us is going to help us with that immensely, I'm quite sure. His name is Wal Thornhill. And I think it'd be better if Wal were to tell you more about himself than me to try to read off a bunch of different things that really express the great accomplishments that this fellow has. Wal is joining us from Australia. It's Canberra, I believe, Australia. And it's already tomorrow there. So you can be sure that no matter what kind of day today was, there's going to for certainly be tomorrow. So without any further delay, I want to jump right into this and introduce our guest this evening, Wal Thornhill. How are you, Wal?
Hi, Jerry. I'm fine, thank you.
It's really great to have you here on the show with us. I was just telling our listeners, you know, reminding them we had a couple of other folks on the past 2 weeks who were really quite fantastic. They had information that was cutting edge, explaining things that we really had no idea about. And I have a feeling this evening it's going to be the same with you. But before we go into very much about what you've been working on, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay. I've always had an interest in astronomy ever since I was at primary school. And when I was at university, I actually built my own telescope and used that for some years. But before I entered university, I read a book which told me or gave me an impossible idea. And that is that the solar system that we see today is not the one that our ancient and prehistoric forebears witnessed. And that book was Worlds in Collision by Emanuel Velikovsky. It was a bestseller back in 1950 when I was at high school. So I was one of the lucky students, I think, who while at university had an alternative to consider. Not just accept what we were taught. And, of course, the argument against Velikovsky's work, which in the principal thing was that it said that Venus is a new planet and that it was witnessed by the ancients as a stupendous comet. In fact, it was the archetype of all comets. Now, the astronomers reacted almost violently to such a suggestion because, of course, we're taught that the Newtonian solar system is like clockwork and has operated for almost 4.5 billion years since it was wound up, and that there have been some disasters in the past caused by comets or meteorites, but they were so far in the distant past that we could more or less ignore that as a threat. In fact, one Australian philosopher said that Newton's law was one of those things that prevents anything nasty happening. Makes us feel comfortable.
Yes.
But so while I was at university, I spent, as a science undergraduate, spent a lot of time in the sociology shelves of the university library, reading the myths and legends and creation stories from around the world. And I found that Velikovsky had made a case that had to be answered. It couldn't be ignored because you could see the same archetypes from everywhere, even the South Pacific Islanders and in the far reaches of the north, you know, in Iceland and so on. So our ancients did witness something, and they thought it was so important that in many cases they handed down these stories word perfect for thousands of years. That's the importance they associated with them. And of course today we associate great importance with our biblical stories, our creation myths and so on. And we ended up with two stories then, because we had the creation stories, the myths and so on, and then we had the scientific stories, which were an attempt to base our science on observation and experiment. That was all very well until we had the beginning of the 20th century, what are known as the two great wars, although there was nothing great about them. They were totally insane. And it seems to me that before those wars, at the end of the 19th and beginning of the 20th century, science was actually behaving quite well. It was doing what it was supposed to do. It was trying to simplify science, trying to reduce the number of forces and number of particles and all this kind of thing. And also, if you read the scientific journals of the time, it was freewheeling discussion. There was very little censorship. After the war, it seems science entered a surrealist period. It wasn't art that started surrealism. I would venture to say that science began it, where we handed control back to the mathematical geniuses. In fact, we'd handed it back to the what in the past you were the ancient astronomers, who had enormous power, which has never been really explained. And here we've handed our power back again to the mathematicians, the astronomer mathematicians. And it's formed, as it did in the past, thousands of years ago, a kind of priesthood. So our science today has more or less become another religion. And I'm not the only one saying that. Some noted scholars, noted scientists have said the same thing, that modern science resembles more the medieval church than it does the rational pursuit of the truth. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so when I came out of university, I began a postgraduate year in upper atmosphere research, but I realized that as a heretic, somebody who didn't believe everything I was being taught, there was no place for me in academia. This has been borne out in the years since, when I've seen many friends and associates in universities being given their walking instructions when they questioned dogma. And that's what we have today. There's our serried ranks of students doing examinations all work from the same textbooks with the same stories in them, so that when they come out of university, you have this enormous army of people who all believe the one thing. They're not presented with alternatives to debate and to discuss and to consider.
That's true.
And I think this is one of the big failings in modern science.
Well, we see it a lot in the work that we do as well. I mean, we do things with archaeologists, and we find things that aren't supposed to be there.
Yes.
And that's because it's not accepted. It's not
in
the textbooks. They shouldn't be written, and it's the way it's supposed to be.
Yeah, we keep repeating the mistakes of the past, and as various philosophers have said, those who forget the past are doomed to repeat it.
Yes.
And the same is about to happen for modern science, because it has got to the point of being totally irrelevant to the public, and the headlines, the kinds of things that make for science fiction stories, not for real science. And the reason for that is, of course, that people scrambling for money have to draw attention to themselves. Well, and that's the whole game now. Modern science is show business. So if you can dream up some wacky theory which gets everyone talking, you've more or less done your job. Mm-hmm. Instead of, as in the past, looking at alternative ideas and balancing them one against the other. There are no alternative ideas right now. The Big Bang is the story. And yet it's complete nonsense. It starts from a miracle. You know, the Big Bang itself is miraculous.
Right.
There is no explanation of how it occurred, what occurred. It's just that scientists like, well, mathematicians in particular, like to be able to retro-calculate. And so when the Big Bang was first proposed, that was a wonderful breakthrough for them, because then they could start retro-calculating about what happened. And, of course, now we've got to the ludicrous situation of them telling us what happened in the first, you know, femtosecond or trillionth of a second or something like that. This is complete nonsense.
Yeah, well, I've not really ever bought into the Big Bang Theory. I've not thought that it was something that I just feel, you know, for what that's worth. I just feel there's something different that's happened, you know, a different way that it began. And you know, you touched on something a moment ago about the money. We know of several different people who, because they were going into what was considered a fringe area, in other words, a footprint, for example, that can't be a million years old, or, different artifacts that are found that cannot exist within the time frame that they are said to have been found within. You know, these folks are ostracized.
Yes.
And any funding they might hope to get, it just evaporates because no one wants to support a kook. And that's what this whole society of learned folks has created, is a society of conformists, basically. Follow the line.
Yeah, you can tell modern science is a religion because they talk about deniers. Now, denial means that you know the truth and the other person doesn't, and they're just denying it. This is nonsense. I mean, that's not science.
No.
Science is about evidence and debate. You cannot call your opponent a denier simply because they don't believe what you do. Science stops dead in its tracks when you get to that situation.
Yes, it does.
As far as the discoveries of things that shouldn't be, you mentioned the archaeological artifacts. In fact, I've been told by some scholars that the British Museum has whole shelves full of things they won't show because they don't match the received datings and so on that are currently accepted. But the same thing is happening in science, where you see reports of planets that shouldn't exist according to what current theory, and stars that shouldn't exist, or they're doing things that shouldn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
This means that the theory that of stars and planets and how they're formed and so on are just not correct, and the alternatives have to be examined.
Well, you know, one of the things when you're talking about things they can't date, that shouldn't be where they are being dated at, our guest last week was Dr. Richard Firestone, and he very conclusively pointed out that there are errors with the decay ratio when using carbon-14 testing. And those errors, he went through a bit of a dissertation explaining exactly why that's not even a valid way to date things any longer.
Mm.
So it's fascinating. You know, they use these old techniques that they relied upon because they thought they were real and trustworthy, and they aren't.
This comes back to the idea that you can retro-calculate what was going on, you know, 1,000, 10,000, 100,000, or a million years ago. And, of course, when radioactive dating was first discovered, or at least proposed, that was like, throwing a lifesaver to a drowning man for geologists, because up until then they were regarded as being a kind of descriptive science, not a hard science. Mm-hmm. Now they had something they could retro-calculate with. And, of course, this relies on what the astronomers had told them, that the Earth has been undisturbed by any goings-on in the solar system for millions or billions of years. But if that's not so, if the Earth is not a closed system and things have been added or taken away or energetic events have occurred, you cannot rely on radioactive dating.
Right.
Because those events, as we've shown in our research, were sufficiently powerful to transmute elements, create radioactive debris, and so on, so that your clocks, in effect, have been tampered with by external means in the recent past, within the memory of mankind. So all of this idea of retrocalculation of dates is suspect.
Yeah, I agree with you. And, you know, the idea that life as we know it here on Earth, people looking similar to what we look like, that's only been going on for the past, 200,000-300,000 years, I think, is what they put that at. Just jumping around to our first guest, Edmund Merridge, he very succinctly put things into such perspective. And he cites your work, as a matter of fact, within his, and has high regards for what you have accomplished. And when we're looking back in time, a very, very long time. You know, you're talking about in some of the things we're going to be talking about soon, the plasma discharge.
Hmm.
Dr. Firestone very clearly illustrated how a supernova exploded, and that energy came blasting towards the Earth. And I'm going to be real interested to find out, you know, what you have to say about that.
Yeah, well, the work that we've done is based on the recollections of mankind. Of course, it requires a almost detective style of investigation, a forensic style.
Sure.
Because you've got all these unreliable witnesses, so to speak, who all tell a story in slightly different ways. And what you have to do is to pick out the archetypes and see if they're repeated across all of the people that you're examining. And this means from cultures all around the world. And it's surprising that you can actually quite well nail down the story that those ancients were trying to tell us, even though it's been garbled by, you know, subsequent events and translations and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And it shows that when planetary bodies come close enough that their magnetospheres, as it's called, mm-hmm. they're actually plasma sheaths, when they touch, then the two bodies see each other electrically.
Right.
And the assumption that all bodies in the solar system are electrically neutral is just an assumption. The ancients said, no, what happens is that these colossal thunderbolts fly between the planets and they create great destruction. And they actually sculpted those thunderbolts, and they look nothing like the little sparks we call lightning. They actually had a very complex form. You've probably seen them represented in the statues of Jupiter, Zeus, hurling his thunderbolt. It looks like a corkscrew football shape.
Right.
The Tibetans have their Dorje, their thunderbolt. All the ancient races, even the Australian Aborigines, talk about the thunderbolt, the lightning brothers, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the lightning from those stick figures came from the elbows and the knees, wherever there's a sharp bend in the plasma column. That's where the discharges occur.
Right.
So we can tell from modern science and laboratory experiments that what they were representing is accurate. Now, that couldn't have been so if this was just some story made up locally and then these myths woven around it. But as Dave Talbot, my colleague, has pointed out, there was a myth-making epoch which was never repeated. So those stories from that time were regarded as so significant that they had to be passed down through generations, untouched, so that it was a warning of what can happen on this planet. But, of course, it all became regarded as allegory, and myth became equated with fiction,
mm-hmm.
and the whole thing was lost because, of course, today we have nothing like it to witness in the sky, or it takes great imagination even to put yourself in the shoes of these people who witnessed these things.
That's fascinating. You know, you're talking about the, because I read some of this. I read some of this on your site, Thunderbolts in the Sky. What is it, Thunderbolts Project? Is that what it's called?
We have a Thunderbolt project, which is actually doing experiments now to study the effects of an electrical discharge on a star.
Mm-hmm.
And the theory behind it is that stars are not what we've been taught, that they are an electrical phenomenon, and that what we see is that bright photosphere in the sky is actually like a global lightning storm, a tornadic lightning storm. It's interesting that the theory of stars was born in the gaslight and horse and buggy era, before plasma science really got off the ground.
Really?
And so it's fascinating to look at stars from this different point of view, which is an electrical engineering point of view.
All right.
The only people who will publish the kind of work that we do are the Institute for Electrical and Electronic Engineers, which is one of the biggest professional organizations in the world. But of course, astronomers never go to their meetings, so they never hear about this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But they have a complete cosmology which replaces the Big Bang and which works and which is actually predictive. We can actually explain things and without inventing new forces and new particles and all sorts of weird and wonderful conditions. And you have the one theory applies to all stars, all kinds of stars. You don't have to invent a new one for every different kind of star. So this is going back to what I said before. This is the way science was before the beginning of the 20th century, simplification, demonstration in the laboratory. Nowadays, we just have speculation and computer games.
Well, this this concept of the stars, you know, I never really gave it much thought, but you're right. That whole thing is right from, you know, well, probably back during the times of, you know, the philosophers in Greece and perhaps even earlier than that. The sun is like a big fire. And
yes,
of course, it would make sense because you put your hands towards it, it feels hot, you get
that's
in the
right.
shade.
The problem for the astronomers at the end of the 19th century was that they couldn't think of any chemical reaction that could keep it burning for the length of time they were finding they had to have to explain what they found on the Earth. So the geologists needed millions of years. The astronomers and the physicists, astrophysicists said, we can't provide you with a sun that'll burn that long.
Right.
So when nuclear energy came along, that was once again another life raft to drowning men. And they grabbed it with both hands, despite the fact that none of the things we see on the sun or above the sun are actually predicted by that model.
So you're
What's
saying...
more,
go ahead.
If you accept the hydrogen bomb explanation for the powering of stars, the night sky should be like the 4th of July because it's an extremely unstable reaction. You know, the stars should be exploding everywhere. And they're not. They're very stable. And in fact, our sun is remarkably stable.
So you're saying that the nuclear aspect of the sun is not a correct model?
It's not the energy source. It's actually just like we use electricity for lighting. Nature does the same in galaxies. It lights the galaxy. The stars form like streams of streetlights, if you like.
Fascinating stuff. That's where does the energy come from?
Sorry, I'm getting background noise there.
Yeah, we have a motorcycle going by. Folks, in case you're wondering, we live on the side of a mountain and about 16 feet from the highway. You're liable to hear noise from time to time. That's what it's like living in a ghost town. They aren't really there. They're ghosts. Well, it looks like we're coming up about 30 seconds or so away from our first break. When we come back, I want to ask you, where does this energy originate from? If this is the case, and I'm following you on this, this is making a lot of sense to me. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, I don't have an answer for this. I'm sure you do. So, folks, we're going to be taking a break here. We're going to be shooting off to the sides for about, 5 minutes. Don't go away. We'll be back right after these messages. Hello, folks. This is Jerry Wills, and I wanted to take a moment to thank each of you for listening to our show. In case you're wondering, this break will eventually be populated with offers and messages from our sponsors. They and your subscription to Expeditions TV make this show possible. If you have something you want to bring to the millions of people listening each broadcast, contact us for details about how you can have your product on my show and others here on Deprogrammed Radio. You'll reach an interested worldwide audience. Thanks for listening. We'll be back in a few minutes to continue the show. Thank you. The guest this evening is Walt Thornhill, and he is just coming back from having made a spot of tea, and we're going to get right back into the program. Are you ready, Walt?
Yeah.
Super. So when we went to break, we were talking about the sun, really, and then about how it's not a thermonuclear reaction that's going on, it's doing all this. You're saying that it has to do with electricity, with the energy plasma, perhaps. And
yeah.
My question was, well, what is it, first of all? And secondly, where does this energy come from?
Well, the energy we observe coming along what we now term cosmic power lines, they're known technically as Birkeland currents because anyone who's witnessed those snaking filaments inside those novelty plasma balls,
well, sure,
will see that electricity in a thin gas travels along a very thin channel, a filament. And even lightning itself will travel kilometers at roughly the same thickness over the entire length.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in space, the same thing happens, only there the gas is so thin that it doesn't glow, so you cannot see it. But it does give off radio waves, and radio astronomers are able to actually detect these cosmic power lines.
You're saying these are channels of energy that are moving through the universe. They're coherent.
Yes. They travel along the spiral arms. They travel between stars. They travel between galaxies. On every scale, we see them. Their origin is unknown because we don't know the extent of the universe. Also, we do not know its age. Once you get rid of the Big Bang nonsense, you go back to being in a state which is much more reasonable, and that is we don't know these things. We cannot say how you create a universe because we don't even understand how you create matter. And when we talk about time and so on being created, that's just semantic nonsense. When you ask what is time, it's a non-question. Time is something we experience. It's not a thing that can be slowed down, sped up, bent, or stopped. So all of the talk about time and space, similarly, space is the idea of location in three dimensions.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a thing that can be warped out of, and you know, to form some sort of path along which a body will move. So the very basics of our science is flawed. We don't know what energy is. We don't know what matter is. We don't know why it manifests with mass. And we have a speed of light speed limit, and it's been set as a constant, when in fact where we observe it, it's not constant. It travels at different speeds in different media. So all of these things are really the real mysteries. Most of the mysteries that you'll see publicized in Scientific American, New Scientist, and other magazines are ones that are manufactured simply because all of the basic ideas are incorrect, which is a hell of a lot to claim, but it's very easy to show. And there are a great number of scientists now who are feeling very uneasy about the situation they find themselves in.
So these energy rivers...
Yes.
Put it into a classic term. They move through the greater cosmos to varying degrees in their strength, density, however you'd measure it. And one of these, or several perhaps, are intersecting at a point where the sun is. How is the sun getting the energy?
Well, the sun sits where... one of these Birkeland currents, as they're called, pinches down. I don't know whether you've ever seen the experiment where you put a soft drink, aluminium soft drink can, inside a big coil and then pass a strong current through it. It squashes the can down,
right,
pinches it at the middle.
I've done that.
Okay. The same thing happens in space. These gigantic Birkeland currents pinch down where a star is, and the star sits at the center, at the focus of this pinch, as it's called.
Mm-hmm.
And the energy is concentrated on this tiny little star at the center of a huge galactic current pinch.
All right, but in the case of the aluminum can, you have something there that's being pinched. What do you suppose is at the center of this current that's being pinched?
I'm not quite sure what the question is.
The sun itself, does it have a composition? Does it have a solid composition that is being squeezed by these currents?
Oh, I see. No, the sun itself isn't squeezed by the currents. It's just that the current itself concentrates down on a star, and it does it in a very complicated way. In fact, this is the kind of work that I'm doing with other scientists and engineers right now to try and clarify exactly how this connection between the sun and its cosmic circuit works. Because we already have evidence for the connection to the circuit. It was discovered a few years ago by the IBEX mission, mm-hmm. which found this ring around the solar system at some distance with glowing hotspots. And this is precisely what the electrical model explains and predicts. You see it repeated in deep space where you find planetary nebula where the circuit is lit up, and you see this beautiful butterfly shape, you know, where the star is at the center and then these two cylinders close down on it, pinch down on it. And that's exactly what I'm talking about. For all stars that are behaving normally, you cannot see the this butterfly shape, but it's there. Now, where the current comes from, the galaxies themselves are fed similarly, like Catherine wheels, on these giant currents which flow down through the centers.
Mm-hmm.
And where two of these giant filaments come close together and intersect is where it forms the pinch and where the galaxy can be found. This explains a whole lot of things that are a complete mystery to astronomers. Why do galaxies tend to all be aligned facing the same way on the edge of these so-called cosmic voids that they find them on? Well, this is simple. If the currents are all flowing in the same direction, all of the galaxies will have their, they'll be face on to these currents. But then you ask the question, where does the current come from that feeds the galaxies? And the answer there is we don't know. As far as we can see, these currents enter and exit our visible universe from somewhere beyond. You know, the universe is far bigger than the little bit that we can see. But the other aspect is, too, that somebody asked, how do you actually generate the particles, the charged particles, to carry these electric currents? And Hans Alfvén, who won the Nobel Prize for plasma physics back in 1970, pointed out that provided the particles are traveling fast enough, they will split electrons off the atoms and you'll form the particles needed to carry the currents. So there's no difficulty in providing the medium to carry the electric currents. The form of the currents is the natural form in space. The observations that we have from deep space, from supernovae, from planetary nebulae, all of these things all fit together. And they have one simple explanation. This is quite distinct from astronomers who have to have separate ad hoc explanations for almost everything they discover.
I was just imagining while you were talking about this, that if we extrapolate that we go perhaps to a fourth dimensional state where we can see things, and for example, we see it as a sphere right now, but let's say this was a two-dimensional universe, and the fourth dimensional universe would be now the third, and what we're seeing are these currents of energy that are rippling through this two-dimensional space. And we're seeing the effects of a much larger a much larger event that is moving through space, but we're seeing it only in part in the way that it's moving through our space, but not the entirety of what this actually is. And the event itself is much, much larger. Is that right?
Well, all we can see is a small part of the universe. The astronomer Halton Arp, who showed that the Big Bang is incorrect with his observations and research, the universe isn't expanding. It seems to be static and of unknown age, and it almost has biological overtones with galaxies giving birth to companion galaxies and so on. The whole story fits together extremely well and matches the electrical engineer's picture of what's happening in space. So, having said all that, we have this unfortunate tendency. Part of the surrealism that came into science with Einstein and people who followed him is this extra dimensions.
Right.
Yeah. Our physical reality is that there are only three dimensions. All you require are three dimensions to measure your place in space. A fourth dimension is a mathematical device which allows you to include things like rotation or some other variable and call it a dimension, but it's not a real physical dimension. And this confusion of language that mathematicians get involved in, unfortunately, has seeped through into almost everything we do. You talk about looking at the universe, say, as a two dimensions sheet. There's two aspects to that. One is there is no physical object that can exist in two dimensions. Any physical object must have three dimensions. It's a representation, that's all. It's not real.
Sure, I meant that.
The other thing is that they use this two-dimensional sheet to explain gravity, which is a bit of a joke because they show the sheet being warped by a heavy object, you know, and they've got this funnel where the heavy object's at the bottom. But that's using gravity to explain gravity because you must have gravity to have this object being pulled down on this rubber sheet. You know, it's really a joke. But people haven't seen through it yet. But in future, I think that people will look back on the 20th century science in disbelief, and it'll be a joke. It really will.
Well, I was trying to explain the two-dimensional aspect of the universe in order to illustrate how a field intersecting our place in the universe, for example, how it would represent or express itself. So you might be able to draw a conclusion from that. But you're saying there's nothing beyond three dimensions. The fourth dimension is a mathematical statement and nothing more. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because a dimension has length and direction. And as somebody said, if you say time is the fourth dimension, point me in the direction of time and tell me how long it is in centimeters. You know, it's nonsense. Unfortunately, it's the language which gets in the way of understanding. When you come back to what the 19th century physicists and philosophers were dealing with, it's something that the man in the street can understand because they were using the same language as he was. Unfortunately, we've adopted the language of the scientists in the early 20th century, which was divorced from physics and was purely mathematical. And you have to keep this distinction between mathematics and physics. Mathematics is not physics. And unfortunately, physics has been taken over and dominated by mathematicians. So our science is in dire straits at present.
Well, one of the things that strikes me about this is that, at least in my understanding, mm-hmm. and I was in electronics for most of my life, is that there's usually cause and effect. But what I'm hearing from you is that there might be cause and effect, but you really don't have any idea what the cause is. You only have the effect part of it, right?
I'm sorry, I'm having difficulty hearing you, Jerry.
Okay, what I was saying is that in electronics, there's cause and effect.
Yes.
And what I'm understanding from listening to you is that you have the effect, you know, that's measurable and it's witnessable. but the cause is not obvious.
That's right. The ultimate cause is unknown because we are limited in both our science presently and also our ability to see the rest of the universe. So we don't know what we're a part of.
But do you have any theories about this? Any ideas? Any thoughts?
No, because it's speculation once you get to that point. The Big Bang is pure speculation, but it's not presented as such. Mm-hmm. And it's based on the mistaken idea that the universe is expanding, and therefore, once again, as I said, the mathematicians could get in and retro-calculate back to a point. Well, that's all very well for them, but Halton Arp showed that he was a student, by the way, of Edwin Hubble, and it's rather ironic that the measurement of this expansion rate is given Hubble's name, the Hubble constant. Hubble himself felt that that was a mistaken interpretation of his work. Right to his deathbed, he did not believe that the expanding universe was the correct answer. He felt there was something that was missing in the science or the physics. And we've more or less shown, Halton Arp showed, he was his student, that was Hubble's intuition was correct. And that the evidence shows that the so-called redshift, which is supposed to measure the velocity and the age of the universe, was actually intrinsic to objects that are newly born. So it's a measure of the youthfulness of an object and not its velocity away from us.
I see.
Of course, the Doppler shift does work for objects, but it's that Doppler shift due to movement away from or towards us is relatively insignificant compared to the intrinsic redshift, which is a measure of their age. The more redshift, the more youthful they are. They shine weakly as well, so they, when an object is born in space from an active galaxy, it shines more faintly and it is highly redshifted, which is low energy, so it gains in energy over time.
So I'm wondering, what experiments are you involved in or are being proposed to get a greater grasp of what is going on?
Back in 2000, we had an expert in plasma physics and high-energy experiments, the highest energy electrical experiments on Earth. And he was able to show that what the ancients were recording and chiseling in rock actually were the things he was seeing in the laboratory. And this was more or less very good concrete proof of our original thesis, which was born out of myths and legends initially. Mm. In other words, the forensic evidence and the scientific evidence came together, converged. Now, the plasma cosmologists explain the universe, but they do not touch the nuclear model of the sun, the idea that it's hydrogen fusion. The electric universe goes further and says that stars are not only formed in one of these cosmic lightning bolts, but they continue to shine as a result of the power source that gave them birth. And we've had plenty of evidence for this in recent years where some wonderful infrared telescopes in space have been able to pierce the clouds of gas and dust and see the stars being born along these cosmic thunderbolts. So we have the evidence that that's how stars are born. And one of the aspects of that that's important is that the plasma people know that material that is attracted towards the thunderbolt and heated, the coolest material is at the center. And the heaviest elements are at the center. So stars have a heavy element core, just like a planet. And it's only the outer atmosphere that's hydrogen and helium. So the sun has a cool, solid core underneath that bright, glowing electrical envelope.
So there is.
And
there
it makes
is
a great deal of sense. When you look at a sunspot, a sunspot is a hole in that glowing exterior.
Right.
And you look through it and it's dark inside. Now, if there was a hydrogen bomb exploding inside there, you would expect it to be blindingly white.
Right.
But it's not.
So there is something some material at the core or at the center, some composition that stars have about themselves. It isn't just plasma, but it is that there's some material there.
It's a solid or a liquid, heavy elements. Iron, nickel, all the things you find in a planetary core.
Are these items that were present first, or did they come about as a result of the energy release?
Yes, the heavy elements. Where did they come from?
Right.
The Big Bang has to cook them up near the beginning, and then it manages the first few elements. And then you have to have stars forming supernovas, and the supernovas are the only energy source that can be considered as the origin of the heavy elements. But then you have the supernovae, a very rare event. And what's more, they're in the business of dispersing heavy elements into space, not actually creating new stars. So it's a very haphazard and unworkable model. The Electric Universe points out that these shells of lightning bolts are actually in the form of multiple electrical tornadoes, and they themselves are sufficiently powerful to transmute elements and produce nuclear energy. So the neutrinos and the so on that we detect on Earth from the Sun come from the heavy elements, which are being formed right in front of our eyes. And what's more, they appear in the spectrum of the Sun, and they will rain down on the core, so that the heavy elements, all stars are in the business of producing heavy elements. It's a much simpler model, it's more sensible, and it matches the observations.
So the energy that's present is actually causing precipitation to occur.
Yes.
The combination of different atoms and so forth to create this.
Yes.
Fascinating.
The fusion story of the Sun is actually a very clever concoction, but it's almost, the odds against it actually working are incredibly huge. It requires on quantum tunneling and all sorts of special things happening, which can only be surmised. And the only reason that the model is accepted is because no other explanation has been put forward that they are willing to accept. Now, until the physicists are taught to think critically and accept alternatives and consider the fact that progress comes from an argument between two different pictures of how things work, we're stuck. Nothing's going to happen until people start looking at alternatives, real alternatives, not just fiddling and twiddling knobs.
Right. Well, amazing material. And I start thinking in terms of, okay, so when a star goes supernova, it has accumulated enough mass to the point to where it's now becoming highly reactive, and this mass is highly radioactive, and it has another separate reaction taking place along with the energy that's running through it, keeping it fired up. Until it finally gets to a point where it just explodes.
I actually have a peer-reviewed paper published by the IEEE, whom I mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. on supernova 1987A, because that's a classic electrical explosion. And supernovae have not been explained by astrophysicists. Their models don't work. They admitted that just a year or so ago. The electrical model shows that the circuit that connects a star to the galaxy is like one of those high-voltage transmission lines that you see crossing the countryside.
Okay, we have a break coming up here. Hold that thought, okay, Walt?
Okay.
Hold that thought. I'm intrigued. Folks, I'm sure you are too. Don't go away. We'll be back in just a couple minutes right after this. Kathy and I have enjoyed a wide range of coffee while traveling through far-flung corners of the world. The Amazon jungle, high in the Andes Mountains, and street cafes in major metropolitan settings. The best coffee, and for sure the best cappuccino, is found at the Flatiron Cafe in Jerome, Arizona. But don't take our word for it. Come find out for yourself. The best coffee in the world, the Flatiron Cafe, Jerome, Arizona. By the way, their chocolate fudge brownies are incredible. They are incredible. Their chocolate fudge brownies are incredible. Don't you think so, Walt? Very good. Well, folks, hello and welcome back. We are back with our guest, Walt Thornhill. And in just a little bit, we're going to do the next experiment at taking calls. I was busy taking a look at some of the settings that I had for the broadcast during that break. And I noticed that one of the settings that I had was just a bit off. So hopefully this will take care of it. You can hear me all right, Walt? Can you hear me, Walt?
I can now, yes.
Okay. Hold up. All right, super. As I was just telling everyone, I was working on trying to get the system running a little more correctly than it was. And I think I've gotten it to a point anyway.
You're coming through loud and clear, but I'm getting an echo.
Yeah, so am I. So that might be an issue that we have to work around as well. I might need to go back to that other microphone.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is giving me a terrific echo. Sorry, folks, we are having a little bit of a technical moment here, so don't get too excited about it. Everyone just sort of stand by. I just have to throw a switch, and there we go. That should do it. Can you hear me, Walt?
Yes, just.
All right. How about that?
Yeah, that's better.
All right. You still hear me and you don't have the echo?
No echo, so I can manage.
All right. So we were talking before the break and getting a little bit more deeply into the whole thing with the sun. And I find it absolutely fantastic that, you know, the particles themselves are combining and creating a core, a nucleus, and building up over the periods of hundreds of millions of years, billions of years, perhaps. And that would explain so much. I think the thing that really confounds me is trying to figure how this energy comes into being in the first place. And I guess it confounds you too. Probably everyone working on this.
You know, the plasma physicist Tony Perrant pointed out in his textbook that just the very motion of plasma, and we haven't mentioned what plasma is, have we? Plasma is a very tenuous combination of free electrons and the atoms from which those electrons have been torn, and therefore they're positively charged. So you've got positive and negative charges moving around in space, and they're subject to electrical and magnetic forces, which are far more strong than the gravitational forces between them. So that a plasma behaves, as you've seen in those novelty plasma balls and that, almost as if it's alive. And this is one of the aspects of the electric universe that I find fascinating, is this aliveness of both the currents that feed the stars, but also as you go up in scale to galaxies and come down in scale to even our own Earth and the auroras, lightning storms, and all of this kind of thing, which are still being tried to be worked out, you know, what actually causes lightning, because that isn't even clear at this stage. But in the electric universe, the whole thing is tied together. It's quite simple.
All right. Well,
hi, Jerry. I went on to hold there for a moment.
Yeah, I noticed that. I'm not sure exactly what happened.
We were talking about supernovae earlier, and I mentioned the fact that stars are connected by these transmission lines, like the high-voltage ones that cross continents. And if you've seen those YouTube videos of them opening the switch on one of those lines, and you get this tremendous arc comes billowing out away from the switch and then up into the air and then dissipates. Well, the circuit to a star can do exactly the same thing, like throwing a switch. If the discharge becomes too intense, it will actually pinch right off, which in effect throws this open switch. And it can happen on the star or even beneath the surface of the photosphere. And the whole star then becomes a supernova. It lights up as bright as the entire galaxy, a single star. And that's because all of the energy stored in that galactic circuit is concentrated suddenly on that poor star that's thrown the switch. It becomes a very simple explanation, and it fits all of the observations, the detailed observations.
Huh. That's, you know, that just really is mind-boggling then, isn't it? I mean, when you consider the volume, I mean, how large of an area we're talking about. So when we were talking in the very beginning of our conversation, you'd mentioned Venus. And that really caught my attention because we've been looking at Venus pretty closely over the years and wondering, you know, some of the same things that are mentioned in the works of Velikovsky. Now, when a planetary object the size of Venus, if it might come close, and you were saying the heliosphere, if they come close enough, there's going to be an energy discharge, right?
So, yeah, a comet is an electrical discharge caused by the movement of a charged object towards and away from the sun. So anything on a cometary orbit will exhibit some cometary characteristics, and that includes an object the size of a planet. Of course, the astronomers at the time when Velikovsky's book came out said that, you know, planets are planets and comets are comets, just by definition. And therefore, one couldn't be the other.
Right.
But Velikovsky had amassed so much evidence that it had to be taken seriously. What's more, Velikovsky was the only person on Earth who, as a result of his theory, was able to predict the very high temperature of the surface of Venus. And, I mean, no one came within... no one came close to picking the temperature almost of that of molten metal. Just a few years before, it was said that it was probably tropical, that the conditions on Venus might be okay for dinosaurs and that kind of thing. And this was seriously considered. That no one thought it would be 900 degrees Fahrenheit, you know, the temperature of an oven.
And do you suppose this is because Venus is in such close proximity to the sun that that energy is moving through Venus as well, causing it to be warm, hot?
The cometary appearance is due to the fact that an object traveling in an electric field like that of the sun tries to adjust, and to adjust it actually discharges. So it's a discharge. The high temperature of Venus is due to the fact, as the ancients recorded, that it was actually, they witnessed it being born from the remnants of a star, a gas giant. And so that Velikovsky had that idea. He was the first one to propose it, I think. And he said, as a result, it has the temperature of the core of a failed star or, you know, of a an object like Jupiter or Saturn.
Mm-hmm.
And he was right. So when a star, the core of a star, because it's got this bright, hot envelope high above its surface, must obviously be well baked. It must be very hot. And Venus was a good example. Well, of course, when the Magellan Orbiter mapped the surface of Venus, it was discovered that it has a new surface, according to the astronomers. And then they had to try and make up a story to say why that happened. So the current idea is that somehow or another, every now and again, it turns its surface over. You know, it has this this spasm or something. But this is another ad hoc explanation, whereas Velikovsky was never given credit for actually having predicted the very high temperature of Venus. And he should have been given credit for that. Well, there was nothing wrong with his research. It was all well documented. It could have been easily examined and tested, but it wasn't. It was just dismissed out of hand.
This concludes the first hour of my interview with Wal Thornhill. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe and leave us a comment. Subscription and your comments cost nothing, but it really helps us a lot. To hear the entire interview with Wal Thornhill and many, many other amazing interviews within our archives, please visit jerrywillsshow.com and become a member. Your membership supports our ongoing broadcasts. That's jerrywillsshow.com. Thanks for listening, folks. We hope you've enjoyed this program.